Today on Wings, Women's Activism for Social Security, the National Retirement Program of the United States. Here's Frances Perkins, who guided the creation of the Social Security Act in 1935. She was Secretary of Labor under President Franklin Roosevelt and the first woman ever to serve in a U.S. President's cabinet.
I think the people of the United States are deeply thankful for the Social Security Act. One thing I know is it is so firmly embedded in the American psychology today that no politician, no political party, no political group could possibly destroy this act and still maintain our democratic system. It is safe. It is safe forever and for the benefit of the people of the United States. Thank you so much.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. The woman who birthed the Social Security Act was very confident that its popularity would keep it safe from politicians, but she didn't imagine the political scenario we are living in today. Many organizations in the U.S. women's movement are doing their best to prevent Social Security from being cut and even to expand its coverage. I'm Frieda Worden. To find out more about Social Security and women's hopes for it, I called on Dr. Heidi Hartman, founder of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, in Washington, D.C. Tell me a little bit first about the Institute for Women's Policy Research. I gather you're having your 25th anniversary this year?
Yes, we are. Well, I founded it with the idea that we really didn't have a think tank that acted similarly to other social science think tanks where studies would be done using quantitative data, basic social science research methods, and showing a problem or an issue and proving that a certain policy would help or solve the issue. And I felt that that was something that was missing in the women's community. We had tons of women researchers coming through the universities. We were beginning to have increasing number of women in Congress and even men in Congress and other legislatures who were interested in their women voters and what their women voters might want. So I felt there was a demand and a supply, but I felt that there wasn't really a vehicle to unite that demand and supply and to create the research and the work that would help advance women's issues.
Now I'd like to know a little bit about yourself, how you came to this kind of work and what qualifications you bring to it.
Thank you. I'm an economist. I think I've always been interested in economics. I got to go to college on scholarship and graduate school on fellowships. Got my PhD in economics at Yale University, and I wanted to get a little closer to the real world. And so I left academia to work first for the federal government. That brought me to Washington. I worked for the Civil Rights Commission. Then I worked for the National Academy of Sciences. And I stayed at the Academy 8 years. And that was what led me to think more seriously about starting an institution like a think tank. And that was 25 years ago. So now we're celebrating our 25th anniversary.
Excellent. So now I wanted particularly to ask you about Social Security. It seems that some progress has been made with women in Social Security issues, but also we're looking at a situation where there seem to be completely different universes of facts about it. Yeah. So I think the first thing would be maybe to ask how Social Security came about and then how it's changed in ways that affected women.
Well, Social Security was voted upon on August 14th, 1935, but I've actually studied Social Security since I was an undergraduate in college. It is a social insurance program, meaning we pay premiums for an insurance product. And the product protects us from some of life's risks. And one of those risks is living long enough to retire. That's a risk I think we all hope we have, that we will live long enough to retire. Other risks that it insures us against are dying prematurely, if we're still working when we die. There are a lot of benefits for our family members, especially our children. And if we become disabled and can no longer work, we get benefits, as do our family members. And this program came about during the Depression. Obviously, there was a lot of unemployment. It was a rough time, really, to start a new social insurance program because the payment mechanism was equal payment from the worker and the employer, up to a certain level of income, which was set fairly low. And the tax rate was very low at the time because there weren't going to be any benefits being paid out. I believe the first benefits weren't paid out until the 1940s. But since then, the program has grown substantially. One of the very first changes that was made, they realized that the benefits that a worker would get would not be very large. And they realized that one way they could increase the benefits to the workers would be to create a benefit for the dependent wife. If that was a male worker, chances are his wife had not worked, and she would need to live in retirement too. And so they created a spousal benefit equal to half of what his benefit was. Then, if he died before she did, which is most typical, when he died, she would then get 100% of his benefit. So these were new benefits that were added just a few years after the system started. And the main motivation was to increase the benefits because with the Depression, workers were left with very little. If they'd had savings, many of those savings were gone. They had nothing for retirement. So this was a way to increase the benefits. Other things were added later. The disability insurance was not added until the 50s or 60s. Then we added divorce in the 70s.
But only after 10 years of marriage, I believe.
Ah, yes, 10 years and consecutive. And of course, it only recognizes heterosexual marriages, does not even recognize today same-sex marriages, even in the states where they're legal. So that's an issue. There are many issues the women's movement has been organizing about for many, many years. But when the system was being threatened from the right by the idea of being replaced by privatization, I would say most of the groups pulled back on their criticism.
Why would women be against privatizing Social Security?
Well, the main thing we realized about privatizing Social Security, although it took us a while to realize it, is that it's really a benefit cut in your predictable, guaranteed benefits. In order to fund you and I to have our own little individual accounts that we can invest in different ways, that would mean that there wouldn't be enough money going into the part of the system that's guaranteed, because our money would be going into our little individual accounts. And for low-wage earners, they would never get enough money in their little individual account to do much with, and a lot of it would be used up by administrative fees. So one thing you could say about privatizing was that, you know, it was the invention of high-income men who don't really want to share their benefits, and they don't want to have a social insurance system with other people less well off than they are. They want to keep all their money for themselves.
Okay. So if it were privatized, then it wouldn't be an insurance scheme anymore, would it? It would just be, you would be investing and taking the risk all on your own of your investment.
Exactly. What makes it an insurance scheme is the pooled effort. For example, most of us who own a home or rent an apartment have fire insurance. And we sure hope our place doesn't catch fire. But if it does, we'll get some benefits. So not everyone retires at the same time. Certainly not every worker becomes disabled, and very few die prematurely. But if any of those events happen to you, and when they happen, the system of social insurance takes care of everyone. In the system of individual privatized accounts, yes, it would be very much dependent on what kind of investments you made, but even more than that, when you retire. Like right now, rate of return is zero, and we had a huge stock market crash. So for people in their 50s and 60s who want to retire now, they're kind of screwed based on their own savings and their own investments, but fortunately they have Social Security. If we didn't have Social Security, then everyone would suffer when the market turns down.
So to privatize Social Security, just to emphasize this point, would in effect be to abolish Social Security?
That's the way I view it, yes. I think that's an excellent way to put it. Privatizing would abolish the system. And right now what's going on is not so much a big argument in favor of privatization. What's going on now is a big argument that we can't afford Social Security and we need to cut benefits. So I view cutting the benefits as pretty much a backdoor method to privatization. Because if we cut Social Security benefits, that means that since people need the same money to retire that they always needed, if not more, they're going to have to save, they're going to have to invest. Where are they going to go with that money? To their bank, to Wall Street.
Now, something very strange has happened recently in that after saying that we couldn't afford Social Security, the amount that's being input into Social Security, the premiums, for both the individuals and the businesses have been cut. And then that cut has been renewed. Could you explain this?
Yes. Well, that was a shorthand method for the Obama administration to try to bring some stimulus to the economy by giving a tax reduction, which would be universally felt. It's absolutely true in a Keynesian economic world, which is the one I was taught and which I subscribe to, that if people have more money in their pockets, they'll go out and spend more of it. So it was designed as an easy way to stimulate the economy. It is not actually costing the Social Security system any money because those payroll dollars that would have been going into Social Security are still going there, but they're going there from the general revenue of the U.S. Treasury. So it isn't actually costing the Social Security system anything, but it is costing the U.S. Treasury something that we aren't paying those taxes.
The Social Security payroll tax holiday expired at the end of 2012 after 2 years. It cost more than $200 billion, which the U.S. government has pledged to replace. That's on top of the vast debt the U.S. already owes the Social Security system, as Heidi Hartman explains.
When employers and employees send in that money, it doesn't just sit there as cash. The Social Security system buys government bonds with it. And those government bonds are only available to the Social Security system. They're not identical to what you and I could buy from the Treasury. And so the government uses that money. That's what it does when it gives you a bond. It says, okay, I'm giving you a promise to pay you back, and now I'm going to go use that money. And that money is used to fund all the activities of government, whatever they are. You know, could be Social Security, could be Medicare, could be defense, could be education, could be health, could be anything.
Assuming the government's credit is good, the amount maintained in the Social Security Trust Fund is sufficient to meet its obligations to America's aging population, at least for the time being.
Social Security tax rates and contributions were increased to cover the eventual retirement of the baby boom. Remember, the baby boom was all born by 1968, so in the 1970s they knew that there would be a lot of people in the future that needed to retire. So that trust fund has grown and grown and grown, and it's now equal to almost $5 trillion. And that's a confusing thing. Some people think that's real, and other people think it isn't real, and the money has been stolen. It's not like the money has been stolen. The government uses money, and it promises to pay you back the money.
Okay, so we still have an IOU from the government for our retirement.
Exactly. And we would have an IOU from the government whether we had a trust fund or not, because any time we give the government money, which we do in our payroll taxes, with the idea that we're going to get it back in Medicare or Social Security, we kind of count on the government to give it back to us when we need it. And that's just a promise, and that's a promise that we hold the government to through our votes. And actually, any of our governments could change it. You know, they created a drug benefit, but they could have gone the other way and taken away some benefit. So basically, whether we have a trust fund or not, whether our retired people get the benefits that they feel they've paid into all their lives is really dependent on our politicians and on our political system.
All right. Do you think that it is in danger, and if so, how?
Well, I do feel it is in danger now. Sometimes I even stay up late at night worrying about it. It seems to be in danger because the right wing has so effectively mounted a campaign saying, oh, we can't afford this. We can't afford this. Too much in entitlements, too much for our old people, not enough for our children. And they've really tried to drive a wedge between young parents of young children and older people. Now, fortunately, most of the public isn't buying it. You can interview and survey Republicans, Democrats, Tea Parties. Everyone will say we do not want benefits cut. But where they are making headway is in the elites, inside the Beltway. I like to say that inside the Beltway is the only place where you'll find people saying we should cut Social Security benefits. And it's people like the mainstream media, the Washington Post, the New York Times. You can hear it on public radio. You can hear it on TV. Kind of a constant drumbeat. We need to cut these benefits. We can't afford them.
The Social Security Administration estimates that after 2020, expenditures will likely start to exceed the amount of interest the Social Security Fund receives from its government bonds. If nothing changes, they think the fund's reserves could be exhausted by 2033. In our interview, Heidi Hartman addressed that issue. If we don't cut the benefits, how could we make sure we afford them?
Well, then we have to increase revenues going into the system. And that's fairly easy to do because, as a matter of fact, not everybody is paying their fair share. So, you know, what we consider would be an easy way to get more revenues into the system is to lift the cap, raise the cap, so that Bill Gates and I pay the same rate on our income, which right now is 6.2%.
So Bill Gates' employer would also pay the same amount, right?
Bill Gates' employer would pay 6.2%. Yeah. And that's where some of the opposition comes from, because if you're an employer, especially of high-wage workers, you realize your tax bill is going to go up.
When was the last time the ceiling was raised? Because I know it has been raised.
That ceiling on earnings is raised every year when average wages go up. So they actually haven't gone up every year, but most years they do. And this year it's set at $110,100. When the cap was first established, about 90% of Americans earned less than the cap. Because we've had more income inequality and more Americans earning above the cap, now that cap, which has moved up with average wages, is only covering less than 85% of American earnings.
At the end of 2012, leading Democrats, including President Obama and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, were calling for a reduction in cost of living increases for Social Security recipients. But a coalition of U.S. women's organizations helped to mobilize public resistance to the cuts. Dr. Heidi Hartman advises increases in benefits, including higher cost of living increases. So I've seen some releases recently, I think on the National Council of Women's Organizations list, about a campaign that is taking place within the U.S. women's movement to expand Social Security instead of contracting. And I'd like to hear about this campaign.
Thanks. Yes, I would love to tell you about that campaign. The National Council of Women's Organizations is our biggest coalition in the United States and has a task force, the Older Women's Economic Security Task Force, which I co-chair with Terry O'Neill of NOW, National Organization for Women. And we've been working for several years thinking about, you know, what's the best way to start surfacing our issues, which is that long before privatization, the women's groups were talking about ways to improve benefits for women. After all, we work hard, but we get paid less, and so our Social Security is lower when we retire. So we can't really expect the Social Security system to do something about our wages, but we do think the Social Security system should treat women more fairly when they work and are married. Right now, you can only get one or the other, either your worker's benefit or your spousal benefit, whichever is bigger. You can't get both. And one of the proposals that women are proposing is that when you become a widow, you don't switch just from your spousal benefit to your husband's benefit, but you get some share of the combination of both benefits, not 100% of it, but 75% of it, which would still leave all women better off. So that's one proposal that has come out actually from the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, which NOW and IWPR wrote with them. So that's one campaign is the one going on there, and they have lots of things in their campaign. The other campaign that OZ is doing is with the Center for Community Change, CCC, and we have only four planks. We've narrowed it down there to four things that we're asking for. But the most important one of which, I think, is caregiving credits. So right now, the Social Security system is based on 35 years of earnings. Many women don't have 35 years because they took time out to care for their families, or they worked less in order to also have children and care for their families, or to care for ill parents or an elderly spouse. Often, since the woman is younger, she winds up taking care of her older husband. And this would give up to 5 years of caregiving credit, so you could eliminate 50 years and get some credit for earnings in those years. So that's just one of the proposals. Another one is fixing the cost of living adjuster. Social Security is very unusual in that it has a cost of living adjustment. Most private pensions do not, meaning it goes up when inflation goes up, but it doesn't go up far enough. It should go up more because elderly people are subjected to more health care costs, and those are rising faster than other costs. Another proposal is for students. Women are the majority of college students in America today, and it used to be before 1983 that if you were a college student and your parent died or became disabled, you could get those children's benefits while you were in college. I mentioned that the family gets benefits when the worker dies or becomes disabled, and those benefits now continue only through high school for the children, but they used to continue through college. So one of our demands is to increase those through college graduation. We're sort of deciding what age they should go up to. It used to be 22, but now it takes people longer to graduate from college, so we're thinking of 24, 25, 26, something like that. And the fourth benefit change we'd like to see is improving the special minimum. There is a procedure where if you worked 35 years at very low wages, if you use the regular formula, your benefits might be below poverty. And there's another procedure called the special minimum to just give you credit for each year of work. And if you had enough years of work, you can almost get up to the poverty level. Well, we'd like to see that formula go up to 150% of the poverty level, and in calculating that formula, to also let women have caregiving years. So it wouldn't take a full 35 full years to get up to that minimum, but it would take, say, 25 years of work plus 10 years of caregiving to get up to that full minimum. And also, we would like to let the threshold of earnings that you have to be given credit for a year of work toward the minimum to be much lower than what it is now. Today, it's basically working full-time at the minimum wage. Many women work part-time. So we'd like to make it about $4,000 or $5,000 a year. If you have that much earnings in a year, you would get credit for a year of work. And if you had 35 of those credits, you would get up to 150% of poverty. So it would definitely enhance the special minimum and take care of a lot of low-wage workers, many of whom are women.
Now, I noticed that one of the campaigns that the Institute for Women's Policy Research was working on recently was about women who are doing restaurant work and about how their base wage is only like $2.03 an hour or something like that. I imagine that many of them aren't even coming up to the minimum wage.
No, unfortunately, they are not. That's a crazy thing in the law that we have. The federal minimum wage allows tipped workers to have a lower minimum wage, which is actually $2.13 an hour, but the regular minimum wage now is 7.25. And in the old days, back when I was a waitress, I was making 52 cents an hour as the minimum, and that was more than half of the minimum wage. Now it's less than a third of the minimum wage. So you can see that the value of the tip minimum wage has fallen even relative to the regular minimum wage. And what that means is that technically the restaurant owner is supposed to make sure you get the minimum wage. How are you supposed to get the minimum wage if the restaurant owner is only paying you $2.13? You're supposed to get it from tips. And the restaurant owner will declare often to the IRS that you made 7.25, whether or not you actually made it from your tips. And then they'll pay taxes on that, and you'll be charged Social Security on the full 7.25. And often you can wind up with a zero paycheck, because by the time they take out all these deductions from the $5.12 that you didn't earn, but they say you did, you'll have less than zero or zero. It's a distressing situation. And of course, the restaurant owners are obligated to pay you the difference. If in fact your tipped wages didn't mean that you made 7.25 an hour, that restaurant owner is supposed to pay you that. But it's widely acknowledged that they simply do not. And the majority of tipped workers are women. Mm-hmm. And many of them are trying to support families. And, you know, it's just, you can barely do it on 7.25, but you certainly can't do it on 2.13.
So you're involved in two different groups' campaigns to increase Social Security. How are you going to put this over?
Well, I think it's going to be, you know, a long struggle. We see it as a multi-year process, but we think the most important part is to start communicating how important Social Security benefits are to workers, how much more important they are going forward. Because once you've had a near depression like we've just had, and people have lost their savings and lost their pensions, they're going to be relying more on Social Security. And so that's the message we want to get out, that in a world where people have to rely more on Social Security, the benefits need to be higher, and we need to modernize the benefits to take care of the ways in which women's lives have changed. I mean, when Social Security was formed, most women were not working, and now most women are working. So there's been an awful lot of changes in the world, and we want to modernize the system to account for those changes. Between all the women's groups, you know, we have millions of members. We've never really counted them, but we can say 12 million. You could also say 20 or 30 million. There are a lot of groups that have a lot of members. They're constantly doing education with their members through websites, newsletters, and so on. So we'll be getting all the groups behind it. The Center for Community Change does community organizing in various jurisdictions. They're focusing on about 10 to 15 states now in the United States doing community organizing. They're going to be bringing this out to their grassroots. You know, one of the things we can organize is meetings with members, especially when they're home in August and on their recesses. You bring some members in.
Members of Congress, you mean?
Yeah, members of Congress. You bring some of your organizational members into their congressional member's office, and you chat with them about how you'd like to see the benefits improved. And, you know, gradually we believe we can get that message out.
When Congress and the White House crafted the infamous fiscal cliff, Social Security was declared off limits for automatic cuts. However, new budget negotiations hold new potential risks.
It's a dangerous time when you've had a drumbeat of saying, oh, we can't afford Social Security, we can't afford Social Security. I mean, the amazing thing is that the whole focus is supposed to be on the deficit and the debt, and Social Security doesn't contribute to the debt or the deficit. It has practically $5 trillion trust fund. So it just makes no sense for Social Security to even be in the mix. Nevertheless, it keeps getting in the mix.
All right. So any advice that you have about how people can get this heard maybe more in the media?
Well, the main thing I would say is that everyone out there who has an interest in what happens to Social Security can be writing letters to the editor, can be writing comments on the blogs that the newspapers are running, calling up the editors and saying, why aren't you covering these issues? You know, the media are very, very important, and the more coverage we can get on radio, on TV, in the printed media, on blogs, on websites, the better off we'll be. Don't be shy about letting your voice be heard. You know, get the information from the sources you trust and believe in, and get your voice out there.
Now, assuming that yours is one of the sources that people will trust, how will they find the information from you?
I certainly hope they trust the Institute for Women's Policy Research. It's our website is www.iwpr.org. It's very easy to find us, Institute for Women's Policy Research or Heidi Hartman. We have a ton of information on our website, and of course the women's organizations do too, but our site will lead you to the other women's organizations as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much for this important information. Congratulations on your 25th anniversary, and good luck on leading this campaign.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Heidi Hartman, founder and president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, interviewed in June of 2012. Since this program first aired, one fact about Social Security has changed. Some same-sex couples may now be eligible for spousal benefits. To hear this and other WINGS programs again, email wings@wings.org. WINGS thanks all our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The WINGS sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden, and this is the Women's International News Gathering Service.